It's working.
That was not your single last.
Okay, I think we're going to get started. Thank you all for being with us today, but welcome. Really wonderful to see some of you that we've seen in years as well as close friends. Really wonderful to be here with you. On behalf of my family, I'm Fred Smagrinsky, for those of you who don't know me. On behalf of my brother and sisters, I'd like to welcome you to this celebration of the life of our mother, Margaret Smagrinsky. Mom passed away November 14th at the age of 95. And let's just keep back our little secret, since she was famously averse to letting anybody know how old she was. That week, we held a small family service at Princeton Cemetery, where she's buried with my father. And the outpouring of condolences and stories and expressions of love that we received over the past 6 weeks has been just overwhelming for all of us. We just didn't realize how many people whose lives have been touched by our mother. So we're so happy that we can be with you today to honor her memory with a broader circle of friends and family members. We have a very simple program for you. I'm going to start by looking back at my mother's life as a trailblazer. Mom was never bound by convention and often reveled in being a contrarian, and I'm going to tell you that part of her story. Then the current director of GFDL, Ron Ramaswamy, will recall the role my mother played as matriarch of the GFDL family. For the uninitiated, GFDL, which you might hear a few times this afternoon, is an acronym, and I won't spell it out for you because it's very long. It's an acronym for a laboratory in Princeton that my dad founded in 1955 and has become one of the world's leading meteorological research institutes. My sister Julie, will then tell you about her mother as mom and how our lives have been shaped by her unique intellect and spirit. And then my sister Anne will describe the more public side of our mother and the life she led outside of our family. Our formal program will end with a limerick that will be read by my wife Holly. And my daughter Tessa Carla. And that will be a fitting tribute for a woman who sometimes described herself as being part German, part Danish, and 95% Irish. And then we're going to invite anybody who's so moved to come forward and share your memories with us that they would like. And then we're going to end, I believe, with song that will be led by our dear friend Gene Brezza. Before I start, if anybody has a cell phone on, you can disable it. And I wanted to make sure that all the members of my mom's family, who they are, start with my sister Anne, my brother Pete, my sister Terry, and my sister Julie. And I also wanted to recognize our cousin Annie, who came up with him, very much a member of our family. And I also wanted to introduce Mom's unofficial family of the last 5 years of her life, Rachel Covert and her daughters, Madison and Kaylee. They were Mom's great friends and gave her tremendous happiness over the past 5 years. And she loved them dearly. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, so my mom as trailblazer. Mom was born in Brooklyn in 1915. And just to create some context, that was 5 years before women were allowed to vote, 12 years before Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, and when ice was still harvested from the Hudson River and delivered to homes by horse-drawn wagons. My mom cut it. We recently listened to an interview that my mom gave to an oral historian, and she recalled much of her youth and upbringing, and she described her younger self as basically being a nerd. She liked school, and she was very good at it. She skipped several grades and graduated from high school at the age of 15. And in fact, with very little prompting, she would gleefully listen to her rendition of the Bay Ridge High School song. We will spare you that. She, like my father, became the first and only member of her family to attend college when she enrolled at Brooklyn College and studied statistics. I imagine being a smart girl back in those times, just a few years after women were granted the right to vote, probably was mom's first break with convention. At the age of 19, she graduated from Brooklyn College, and during the height of the Depression, when jobs were scarce, she moved to Ashland in upstate New York to take a job as the sole teacher in a one-room schoolhouse. Her parents had a house up there, no electricity, no water, but yet that was a place they went in the summertime to have fun. And so they knew people up in Ashland, and she took a job up there with a farming family named the Puddles. It must have been a very difficult challenge for a teenager to take on this teaching this variety of ages. We know from many stories my mother told and friends of hers told her that she was a much beloved and innovative and energetic teacher, which of course is no surprise. The best part for our family was that 4 years that she spent in Ashland gave us a lifetime supply of stories and turns of phrase that she picked up from the Puddle family. Prized favorites in our house were, she was all dressed up like Astor's pet billy goat. he was as sore as a boiled owl. Expressions you'll still hear around our house. After 4 years in Ashland, Mom moved to Washington, D.C., where she worked for the Railroad Retirement Board as a statistician, and then as the first woman statistician hired by the Weather Bureau. The Weather Bureau then sent her to NYU to take a graduate-level course in meteorology, which is where she met her dad. If I told you nothing else except for the circumstances that surrounded my parents' marriage, that alone would tell you a lot about my mother being a trailblazer, and my dad, too, for that matter. When they got married, my mother was 32. That's not uncommon now, of course, but back then it was unusual. In the 1940s, I think when I was writing this the other day, I did a Google search, and I found that the median age at the time of marriage was 20 for women. And so my mother was 32. In addition, my father was 8 years junior to my mother. And one other small issue, my father was raised in an Orthodox Jewish household, and my mother was from a Catholic family, had gone to Catholic schools, and still attended Mass. Needless to say, it was not a well-received union. with only a justice of the peace and a handful of friends and family members in attendance. Although they subsequently had a Catholic ceremony to appease our grandmother. The next stop on my parents' adventure was when my father was invited to a project at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in the early 1950s, where John von Neumann was building the world's first modern digital computer. Many of you may have heard of the Institute, because that's where Einstein went when he left Germany to come to America. A group of meteorologists was included in this project team because weather prediction was selected as the best problem to test the capabilities of the newfangled device that John von Neumann was building. I don't know many details of how this came about, but somehow my mother was drafted into the project to provide assistance to the machine's program. So she was actually involved in the work that was being done by the world's first computer programmers. It's astonishing for me to think about how the precocious schoolgirl from Brooklyn was now chilling with John von Neumann, who was considered one of the most prolific geniuses of the 20th century. And both of my parents have great stories about John von Neumann and his performances at cocktail parties at the Institute, where he would dazzle people with his ability to recite pi to 300 decimal places. very complex calculations in his head. At about the same time, mom and dad, they decided to start their family when they were in Princeton at that time. She had Anne when she was 36, and then gave birth to four more of us over the next 8 years. So again, not the usual pattern for women at that time. We never had any idea that Mom was older than our friends' mothers. And in fact, we often look back in amazement at some of her accomplishments over the years. At one point, I remember Julie and I found Mom's driver's license during the 1970s, and we discovered with horror that I think she was 56, and which we thought was so old. That was really the first inkling that we had that Mom was not the same as the other mothers and our friends. So we look back over the years and think about things that she did at different points in her life and calculate how old she was. And we often shake our heads. And the one we were talking about recently is when she pushed a burning refrigerator out of our parents' garage in the middle of the winter. And one of those spontaneous fires that can happen in the old fridges. And I guess she had an adrenaline rush. And she saw this thing burning and she pushed it so it wouldn't burn the house down. She pushed it out of the garage and into the snow. And that was when she was at the age of 82. Even her longtime friend and family doctor didn't know her true age until she turned 80. Apparently she didn't feel like that was, he needed to know. At that point, he told her that she was a member of the biologically elite, which says, it certainly does describe a mom. She devoted her life to raising us, and her professional career never was able to flourish. But she never stopped moving forward. I just wanted to pick out a few small examples of how our mom continued to pursue every opportunity to learn and grow that she could find throughout our lives. When I was growing up, I never asked my dad for help with my homework. He was likely to suggest a differential equation as the best way to solve a high school math problem. That really was not going to be very much help to me. So I'd go to my mother, and what she would do is she would take my book and send me away, and she would learn whatever I needed to learn, and then she'd call me back, and she'd teach me. But she loved it. She loved being asked for help because I gave her an opportunity to learn something new. Some of you might remember the dense and intellectual bestseller that Umberto Eco wrote in the 70s called The Name of the Rose. Big, thick book. It was his first novel. He was an academic, an Italian academic, who wrote this very dense novel. It was on the bestseller list. I'm pretty sure most people never read it. It was just a very difficult book. She read that book and did it with tremendous enthusiasm because it gave her an opportunity to research all the obscure references throughout the book. And she did this with great brother. So that's, I have a very strong memory of when my mom decided to read The Name of the Rose. Another point in the lives, I believe, was in the early 70s. She went on a trip to the Soviet Union with my dad, who would often go there to visit with delegations of scientists. And prior to going, she spent months studying Russian because she wanted to be proficient in Russian when she got there. And I don't know how proficient she got, but a favorite story that she liked to tell was a time when, I think toward the end of her trip, and she'd been going on a tour bus with these Soviet tour guides who kept them on a very tight leash. And at one point, the tour bus was going to be leaving in a few minutes. And she dashed off of the bus, saying over her shoulder to the startled guys, "Я спешу на почту писать письмо." I took Russian 30 years ago. Trying to draw it up. So, in Russian, that means I have to rush to the post office to mail a letter. Which was taken directly out of one of her phrase books. Exactly the right moment to use it. So she went down the road, and she got back on the bus, and she said there was an eerie silence as one of the tour guides said, it appears it's a Snagurinsky knows a little bit more Russian than she's been letting on. Dawn was driven by a restless curiosity, and she had no fear. She was never bored and would never tolerate any less sane than we were. And her helpful advice was, which Carla recalled for me the other day, only boring people are bored. At the funeral that we held last month, Anne beautifully captured the special quality when she said, "Mom never seemed to shy away from doing something because it would be too difficult, too scary, too outside our experience. To Mom, life was an endless series of opportunities to try new things, take on new challenges, and learn. She truly was an inspiration and a role model for a full life well lived." So I would like to invite Dr. Ramaswamy up to recall my mother's role at GFDL in Princeton and in Washington.
Thank you. I'll try to do justice here. I was, I guess, unfortunate, but I joined GFDL, which, by the way, I'll explain, stands for Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. It's a tongue twister. It's fluid and dynamics, the same breath. And it's a lab, one of the research labs of NOAA, which stands for National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the United States government. So this lab, Joe was the one. Now, I'm increasingly moved to say it's Joe and Margaret, because after listening to reading Margaret's history, which I wasn't fully aware of until the opportunity here, and then you're the eloquent summary, caused me to think that really Margaret was a full force behind the whole concept of GFDL and what it stood for and what it still stands for. So GFDL was created by Joe as a sort of a desire to improve and get into the business of weather prediction. Actually, Joe was more into climate understanding and prediction. It was a very pioneering thought, because back in those days, weather forecasts were just, at least we're talking about the 50s, early 50s to mid-50s, weather forecasts, the idea had just started. And so people were prompted to look at how you can predict the weather a day in advance, 2 days in advance. But Joe was quite far-sighted for those times. He actually saw that the whole issue of not just short-term weather, but even long-term weather, which we call climate, is something that should be pursued, and that there is a science to be done here. And it is a very unique thought, because there was no one else in the world who was thinking like that. And Joe, I have to say, with Margaret's assistance, I'm sure, really initiated the whole thinking of climate and started this lab. And then, through a set of circumstances, actually arranged with Princeton to have this lab set up here, because originally the lab was in Washington, D.C. Joe wanted to, I think, move away from Washington. And the idea of going to Princeton, where you could have a collaboration with an academic institution, really was a pioneering thought. And everyone has pioneering thoughts, but you have to sort of realize where that lab is today. It's sort of held the leadership of the world's climate science for now 6 decades and continuing. And this is really a tribute to Joe and Margaret, because it was not just building up the intellectual force that one can then call as climate science and understanding and prediction. There was also the nurturing of it, which actually took a lot of insight, because Joe had to identify people who could actually form part of this lab, and it was incredible the people he chose. But then Margaret was a real force, and as I said, I joined GFDL 2 years after Joe retired, so I didn't have the fortune to be in the lab when he was leading it. But 26 years later, and being the fourth director of the lab, I'm beginning to really, really appreciate what all Joe was able to do, which actually in these times it's not even possible to think of. But Joe was a masterful director. And when he built up the lab, but there was a sort of a human aspect to it which I want to bring out, and which I believe was entirely due to Margaret. For the lab had a lot of new people coming in, And while Joe would, you know, direct them in their academic and intellectual work, Margaret was really making them feel very warm at GFDR. So GFDR is one of the few science labs in the country now, one of the few climate science labs in the country where people don't leave. Once they come, they stay. And I believe this is a tribute to Margaret's warmth and her devotion to probably not just her family, but she regarded the whole GFDL as a family and really nurtured the institution, providing all the assistance she could to the Joe behind the scenes, so to speak, which is kind of getting revealed only now, because as you mentioned, she was not very keen to have the all the platitudes stolen on her. And I remember, so I used to meet Joe and Margaret often during functions, primarily during functions when they used to come to GFDL. And the one particular one I remember is the 50th anniversary of GFDL in 2005, where I, if I'm not mistaken, Margaret gave the speech that Joe was supposed to give, and Joe was there. But I recall a conversation that Margaret and I had. I was not the director then, I was just a senior scientist in the lab. And Margaret said in no uncertain terms that how much they had worked so hard for GFDL. And she just narrated a lot of incidents where she made sure that people in GFDL felt welcome. And she really went out of her way to accommodate all the visitors coming from abroad. And there have been a lot of visitors from abroad. And she really went off her way to make them feel warm and welcome. I think, I don't know if you'll hear stories later about all the games and plays she used to have during the holiday season, especially Thanksgiving. I've heard a lot of stories about them. I didn't know any of them, but apparently they were a lot of fun. Easter hunt, the egg hunt, and also, of course, she really loved it. I mean, she really liked to interact with people, and so, you know, I won't belabor this point, but everyone at GFDL today, what GFDL is today, still continues in the Smagorinsky tradition, and that those were really golden years. I mean, not that they're over, but they're still continuing, but it's a tribute to really dad and mom that the institution is what it is. And I think I can say on behalf of all the people at GFDL, some of the people who came in Joe's time have retired. In fact, some of them are in the audience right here. But I think one thing that both the people who retired and the new people coming in who just happened to sort of hear about what were the days like when Joe was director, I think we all feel that Joe and Margaret left something that's just for a continue forever. It is just so stimulating. The ideas that act as stimulants 50 years ago for them, they still continue today. So I think that's a legacy that will stay on forever. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What a great public speaker I am.
I've been given the role of talking about what mom meant to us as our mother. Fred already touched on several of the aspects of mom that I had originally intended to mention. He stole the source of all that.
Siblings.
My idea first, but anyway.
Always like Fred.
So I consider myself to be mending his lovely presentation. I think we all know that mom was always what you'd call a character. She set a high bar for witty discourse and dry ironic repartee. When I think of her, I always picture her with a little smile as she described a person or a situation with her characteristically elegant turn of phrase. And yet she was equally adept at summoning colorful, more homespun phrases from her childhood. This is where I was going to say swords of Wuhan.
Swords.
anyway, my it was, moms always seemed different from other moms. She would engage in conversations with our friends, not just say like, "Oh, that's wonderful." But and then none of the other mothers would describe feeling a little bit down as feeling piano. Or would try to boost their children's spirits by saying, "Cheer up, my lad, why be sad? Tomorrow is your wedding day. See, here come the villagers." Mom was unique in her outlook, her quick mind, her humor, her knowledge, her fearlessness, and her 24-hour-a-day dedication to her family. As Terry said recently, she was there for each of us every step of the way. That's a lot of steps when you multiply them by five. Terry's a math teacher. Mom is our guiding light. She was ever curious, ever confident of her ability to tackle obstacles, and she set a great example to us with those qualities that was sometimes difficult to live up to. Mom loved her freedom. She loved to drive ever since she was a young girl, and one of the hardest pills she ever had to swallow was being deprived of that pleasure a few years ago. Up to the end, she talked about getting a new car. By then, we had all learned to not and listen to her plan. Christmas and Thanksgiving were glorious holidays in our house, full of traditions from her childhood and ones we added on as the years went by. And the traditions were always piling on. With her tender touch, Mom embraced any gesture we loved, like having waffles for dinner one Christmas Eve, as a new tradition in the making. She was such a font of knowledge. You couldn't wonder aloud why the winter sun always seemed directly in your eyes, without Mom hauling out a globe and an orange. Earth around the sun throughout the year. As Terry has said, you didn't need Google when you had Mom. Terry also commented that money was not a big deal to us growing up. We didn't do frivolous things. We had a lot of hand-me-downs, homemade clothes, both sewn and knitted. So some examples of the knitting there. Mom cut our hair. She made all our meals at home, which we loved because she was a great cook. And we had only one car for many years. And Terry said, Mom made all of this seem like an adventure, not a limitation. Everyone who knew Mom knew of her adventurous spirit. She tackled any new challenge with gusto, including researching and organizing those famous car rallies. Please sit in my... mastering the history of Princeton University and its gargoyles, legends, and lore, learning to speak Russian, and how to bone a fowl, a la Julia Child, fixing any broken thing in the house from the toaster to the air conditioner, refinishing furniture, and doing her own statistical analysis of the home court advantage as she knitted fabulous sweaters while watching her beloved Knicks. When our wooden puzzles lost pieces, she would whip out the jigsaw and cut new ones. When Dad had a heart attack and had to change his diet, she left behind a lifetime of accumulated recipes for comfort food, like pork chops and gravy, meatloaf, and standing rib roast with Yorkshire pudding, and quickly mastered a new repertoire of light, delicious cuisine. And when our oil tank, which was located in the basement of our house in Virginia, exploded a couple of days before Christmas, and we were forced to spend the holiday in a motel, she managed to not only to pack us all and our living grandmother up, but she didn't forget to bring along the cookie cutters so she could still bake our traditional Christmas cookies. She told me years later that she was quite worried that staying in this shabby motel on Route 1 outside Washington, D.C. would ruin the holiday for us. But her brave face and manner at the time told a different story. To this day, that Christmas stands out as a fantastic adventure in all our memories. It has been difficult over the past few years to see that adventure end. I think that losing Dad changed everything for Mom. She lived with Terry quite securely for several years, but always missed her life with Dad in a difficult place. As much as she loved her freedom, both Mom and Dad loved their home life. Even now, the child in me wants to walk through that front door and see Mom bringing Dad his sherry and her cocktail into the sitting room to enjoy in front of a lovely fire, looking up some little airline trays that Mom saved from the lawn. Well, now they're together again, at last and for eternity. Maybe they're driving around in Mom's new car. Or our old station wagon that Dad always said had such comfortable seats. When Mom was young and unmarried, she promised herself that if she ever had children, she would enjoy them. She certainly did. We never doubted that we were the center of her life. When she came to stay with me after I had my first child, I told her that I didn't know what I would have done without her help. She was bursting with happiness, as she said, "It's so good to be needed again." Mom, you can never die. You are our fearless leader, and we feel your spirit wherever we go. You will live forever in our hearts.
I really don't like having to follow that.
In a super large type.
No, I don't need reading glasses, I just need large type. The aspect of Mom that I'm going to talk about is the mom that everybody wasn't related to her in this room, which was the mom of her public role. It's a little funny to think of Mom as a public person because she was in many ways very shy. It was difficult for her to ramp herself up sometimes. To be the mom that I think you are, the Margaret Smegrinsky that you all knew. The typical of her, she didn't let her fears get in her way. As those of you who knew her remember, she brought her full arsenal of wit, inventiveness, generosity, and thoughtfulness to her relationships outside our family. I'm going to touch on just a few of those types of interactions. The first thing I think that a lot of people think of when they think of my mother is her car rallies. She would have one of these events about every 5 years. It began out in Washington, but she really brought the form to full fruition after we moved up here to Princeton. Just for those of you who never got to participate in one of these, you'd start usually at Mom and Dad's house. You'd have a stirrup cup to send you on your way. You'd be giving your first clue, and you were already lost. Sending Tim to the driveway. Because all the clues were written in rhyme, and they were all very, very, very tough to decipher. It takes a rare combination of navigational skills, knowledge of the geographical area, preparation, skill at doggerel, and spunk to plan and execute the type of car rally my mother was famous for. The routes were circuitous, the rhyming directions were inscrutable, and the tasks required were hilarious. If there's anyone else in this country who puts together events like Mom's Car Rally, I've never heard about it. What I have heard is people reliving the events over and over till they've almost passed into mythology. And I'm sure that the people at the small local store who were run over one year by rally or something for canned sardines will never forget them. But she always had little weird tasks like that where everybody would have to descend on some remote outpost to get some obscure thing that they usually ran out of because how much cancer do you put in stock? My mother, as the mother hen of G.F.D. Allen, Rahm spoke so eloquently of this, I don't need to belabor it, but if my father was the patriarchal figure of the geophysical fluid dynamics lab, his mother was the nurturer of countless new lab families, including many foreign families in the U.S. for the first time. The lab attracted a number of prominent or soon-to-be prominent scientists from around the world, and their families were often completely new to all things American. Starting with the very first families in the 50s, so shout out to the Vanabis. Mom made it her job to take these people, generally the wives, the men were off working here, under her wing. Whether in Washington or Princeton, she devoted herself to befriending these newcomers, and I can't underemphasize or overemphasize. I can't tell you enough how much it wasn't just her duty as the first lady of GFDL to do this. My mother made so many friends of the families at GFDL, befriending these newcomers, helping them acclimate to their new surroundings and culture, leading tours of the area, and of course hosting her famous parties, dinner and otherwise. Partly to stem from Mom's fascination with other countries and their people and customs, and partly just her sense of responsibility for all these newbies. We received so many thoughtful notes and emails from people who knew Mom, and many of them included anecdotes about GFDL families who received the Margaret Snagurinsky welcome. Harriet Bryan, whose husband Kirk was at GFDL for some 50 years, remembers, "Your mother's social events made us feel at home in a strange city, and for us a new part of the country, coping with the joys and anxieties of raising young children. Your mother was always very helpful with encouragement and common sense advice. The lab had a rich diversity of people from just about every country. Concerned about the wives of these foreign members of the staff, Margaret started a monthly get-together. She would lead wives to a museum, or once all the museums in Washington were visited, she led them outside the town to historical mansions and once to a fossil site along with Potomac. I remember these trips with great pleasure. It was a wonderful way to get to know everybody. Your mother enjoyed this diversity." And Janet and Gareth Williams sent us a note saying, "Margaret made an incredible contribution to the lives of all the young, often foreign scientists and their families, by welcoming us to your home so frequently and arranging interesting outings for the spouses, particularly during the Washington years, but continuing on as we moved to Princeton. Together with Joe, she created a true feeling that GFDL was like an extended family for all of us and helped make the transition to life in America much easier than it would have been otherwise," which I think is the point that Ron made so eloquently. But I think you're going to also start to hear, as I'm talking about Mom's interactions with people outside of our family, how she brought her incredible sense of family to every interaction that she had, and mothering all these families at GFDL and embracing them as her own family was certainly part and parcel of that. In a similar way, mother had to Princeton students. Fred and I got to share Mom in a special way during our years as college students. We went across the street to college. We both have legions of foreign roommates and friends who regarded 21 Duffield Place as their home away from home during their college years, and some of you were here joining us today. I had dinner with a former roommate, a lifelong friend, a few nights ago, and she remembered being a trepidatious Southern girl who found a welcoming home around Mom's kitchen table, where she learned that smart, educated Northerners could also be warm, funny, unpretentious, and endlessly fascinating. And they love her to this day, even if they haven't seen her in decades. Mom, the author. Mom's interest in writing went back to her school days when she was on her high school literary magazine. We have a copy of one of her early writing works out there on one of the tables. From car rally clues to crossword puzzles to indignant letters of complaint to all manner of companies, Mom reveled in the
love of writing. Copy of one of those, too.
Copy of a letter out there, something to do with vinegar that had to be returned because they simply didn't measure up to Mom's high standards. Mom reveled in the love of words and words well expressed. So it was only natural that at the youthful age of 75, continuing, you know, Mom never let age be a barrier, she would try her hand at writing longer works. Margaret authored a series of pamphlets, and then there's a bound copy of the pamphlets that she wrote at Princeton University out there, about subjects pertaining to her beloved Princeton University and the campus. These works are still sold at Princeton Art Museum, Princeton University store, and we even found them the other night on Amazon. They're written with Mom's famous love of original source research and her one-of-a-kind dry humor. And last but not least, the volunteer. When we were young, finding time for volunteer work was time that a hands-on mother of five simply didn't have. But after we moved to Princeton in 1968, Margaret started giving her time to the University League, where she served as board member, president, and longtime organizer of the Furniture Exchange. So I'll have some furniture exchange for her. Just as she loved welcoming newcomers to the GFDL family, Mom loved welcoming newcomers to the Princeton University community. Much of her work was behind the scenes organizing, but she was also quite famous for her campus tours on behalf of the league and her gargoyle tours, highlighting the many and diverse gargoyles and grotesques on the Princeton campus. The legendary. Landon Jones, a friend and neighbor of our parents, recently noted Mom's death by saying, "We had lost a real Princeton presence, one who had lived life to the full." I'm not even going to try to add to that appreciation. She will be truly missed.
Well, it was some birthday. Again, we all want to keep the age thing. So it was written for a birthday, and so we're providing it again, a little bit tweaked, and her granddaughters, Carla, and two of her granddaughters, Carla and Tess, and Holly English will present it.
There once was a young lass from Brooklyn who wound up a lady princess. In between, there were stops upstate and down south, and she made her mark in each one of them. She knows much of Princetoniana, university rights, tigers, flora, and fauna. But on one topic it's clear, the lady has no peer, the arcana of Garbologna.
The lady, of course, is Margaret Snagurinsky, known also as Marg, Mom, and Granny. Whatever her moniker, today we shall honor her as the bright, shining star.
So we thought we would invite anybody who wanted to share any memories or anecdotes or jokes. If you'd like to come up, we'd be welcome to do that. Or just stand up where you are.
I'll stand, because my almost six-year-old is saying, "Mommy, it's your turn, Mommy, it's your turn." I don't know why. But for those of you that don't know us, Fred was so nice to introduce us. My name's Rachel, this is Madison and Kaylee, and we were very lucky to have met your mom, your granny, who we adopted as our granny when they were born. They never got to meet my grandma, so I guess we had to go find our own. And I really just want to say thank you, because it was so nice to be welcomed into the family and to have a granny to spoil them, to play with them. We spent about 2 to 3 days a week with her for the past 6 years, and many memories that they didn't get to make with my own grandma, they got to make with yours. So we just want to thank you for sharing, and some silly memories. She would sing to my girls nursery rhymes and songs that I never knew. And do one of you want to say what Granny's favorite song to sing to you was? I love you?
Yeah.
Go ahead, say it. You want to say it? I love you. A bushel and a peck? Yeah. And where's the hug? So anyway, we just loved her, and I really do appreciate, and please stick around and spoil my kids as much as she did. Most of my family's gone, so we had a good time this past almost 6 years. And just so you know, I was feeling very special until I had them, and I ceased to exist once they were born. So, any of you true grandkids out there, if you're jealous at all, it's just because they're little and cute. Because she did not even look at me anymore when I walked in the room. It was, "Where's Madison and Kaylee?" So, thank you.
And all of our family. We have shared with the Smagurinsky family all sorts of holidays over many years, and one of the outstanding features of many of these, including all the Thanksgivings held at Duffield, was Margaret's famous boned turkey. And when she took all the bones, every bone, out of the turkey and then sort of mushed it together and strapped it up so that when it was served, it was just this big large ovoid thing, and there were no bones in it. And how she did that, we never could understand. But she learned it, and it was absolutely special. I've never seen such a thing ever before or again. Unforgettable. Just one of her talents.
I'm Brian Moore, one of the members of the TFDL group, so we'd like to add a few words to express my gratitude to your mom and grandma, and Margaret and Joe. During our Christmas celebration in Vermont a few days ago, I mentioned to my son-in-law that I was going to a memorial service by Mrs. Pavlovinsky. He said, oh, the name Pavlovinsky is familiar to me, because I had a Mrs. Pavlovinsky as a substitute teacher in Montgomery High School. In algebra. She said she was nice, but she was quite firm. He was in the council, a substitute teacher, you don't have to do anything. My wife, Inka, couldn't make it here today. However, she sends you, Pete, Anne, and Terry, and Julie, and Fred, the very best wishes. She remembers your mom for her warmth, hospitality, wit, and her sense of humor. This especially came out during the monthly TPL ladies' outings that were organized often by your mom. I've been a member of Joe's TFDL team for more than 30 years. Billy and I got to know your parents first for 2 years in Washington, D.C., and then for 30 years in Princeton. They played a very important part in our life. Actually, we'd like to mention the first night we arrived from a home country, the Netherlands, in 1966, in a new apartment in Soetland, Maryland. And your parents came to visit us unexpectedly. They came in with a big bottle of wine and lots of pots and pans to help us to get our household going. And it was very wonderful to be there because we had missed the night before. We slept in, we missed the tradition of the connection to Washington. So we had to sleep in a hotel room. We had this 1 and 2 year old sons. And they kept us awake all night. So this was really remarkable. Your parents' welcome made all the difference for us in feeling at home in our new country. We also remember fondly the New Year's receptions at your home and the amazing car rallies, which were mentioned before. Then there were many TFDL picnics, dinner meetings with foreign scientists, and so on. What we really admired in your mom was that she could give up her professional career as a statistician to devote full time to educating the children and to your dad's work. This was not easy for her, but she probably realized the importance of education and of helping your dad in his work as director of TFDL, his unique creation to the earth sciences. Your parents have been a great example for us, both as parents and also as leaders, and of how one can work hard for what one believes in, and at the same time deeply care for the welfare of one's family and other friends. So I encourage you, the next generation, to follow our example. Thank you.
I have a little story to tell about Margaret and Joe, and I related it to Freddie and Pam just today. As neighbors will be neighbors, one cold winter night, we got a call at our house, and incidentally, our house, the backyards faced each other, so we could see the Smags could see us. I get a call from Margaret that she's concerned that she had been calling Joe, who was supposed to be at home, and there was no response. She said, John, would you go over there and knock on the door and tell him that I'm trying to call? I said, sure. So I went over there and I'm knocking on the door. No answer. For a few minutes I did the was knocking on the door, no answer. But I noticed that when I was coming from my house to the Smags' house, there was a light up in the bathroom. So I thought, gee, you know, I've got to find out about this. So what I did is I went back home and I got a 30-foot ladder. This is in the snow. And I bring it up, put it up against the house. And the bathroom light was on. The window was ajar about this much. I climb up that ladder. They go, Joe, call Margaret. And I guess he did because I
I'm Andy, and I am the cousin to these five wonderful people and these a very wonderful woman. I wasn't prepared to say anything, so just give me a second. But I do want to say that she meant the world to me and to my brothers who are not here. If I'm not mistaken, my oldest brother, Kevin, even spent, at least 6 months to a year living with them up here in Princeton. And I know that that meant a lot to him. But in particular, growing up when they were in Alexandria, I lived in Fairfax, they were in Alexandria. My mother worked, their mom was an at-home mom, and she included us in everything. We went to baseball games, we went to the zoo, we went on adventures everywhere. I remember the Easter egg hunts with the hidden Easter egg that was the special egg, and if somebody found it, I think one year somebody didn't, probably in the back of a chair somewhere. But I do remember when I was telling my friend Mike about this not too long ago that every Christmas we would make a gingerbread house. And I remember, I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, kids, but she put it in the middle of the table, I think on New Year's Day, and we, all of these arms would go to that house and just break it apart, and we would eat this very old. But it was so much fun because the house was made every single year with love, and that's what she gave not only her immediate children, but the children of her sister. And she was wonderful. So thank you.
Stand events like this without, you know, starting to tell a story. Margaret was my consuera. In Spanish, you know, that means that the in-laws have a special relationship, and so my husband Alan and I were Joe's and Margaret's consueros. And that's a very interesting combination. For how many of you have mothers-in-law, fathers-in-law, and some of them you adore, and some of you some of them you say, you know, well, we don't really talk too much. But Margaret, for me, Margaret and I talk politics. Margaret was a retail person about politics. It was very, very personal. And if she had written a letter, for instance, to Senator Bradley, and he didn't answer back, it was my job to explain to her about why he didn't, or to call him and say, hey, get on it. Because Margaret wants to know this, and if you don't answer, here's why it could be. Margaret wasn't shy about sharing her opinions with others about these, you know, these people who were not polite enough to respond. So we would have this ongoing dialogue about what was going on in the world or very, very local. However, early on, I learned something about her, and that was if I couldn't begin to do it myself, if I suggested to Martha that she make a dollhouse, she did. So I ordered this gigantic thing, gave it to Margaret, and wouldn't you know, the dollhouse still lives at Holly's and Fred's house. And then there were other things that I would find, and I would delegate to Margaret. Margaret, how about you petty point this? And she did. I certainly miss having someone to delegate to. So if any of you have this burning desire to come into this, but she was a hoot. And always looking forward to seeing us and being, of course, she was so proud of her family. So if I didn't have any other time, I could listen about Margaret. Have they done anything badly? Don't know. Oh, no. And then she would tell me all about it, especially the grandchildren. So, Margaret, here's to you.
My name is Rick Smith. I'm one of the roommates that you heard about. Fred's roommate, not Anne. And I can tell you that being at dinner at the Smagorinsky household was really, really something special. I mean, it just left an impression that I just can't quite explain. And for Margaret in particular, it was an interesting combination of first someone who you knew had very high expectations of everyone who was around her. And you did not mind at all trying to meet those expectations. But also someone who is extremely warm and graceful and open. And in fact, very tolerant on occasion. In fact, if Fred's other roommate, Cap Cooper, were here, you would learn just how tolerant she could be.
Oh, I tell the story.
I can't. Fred has to tell the story. But, you know, it is odd how people can leave an impression in just the oddest way. And things will carry with you throughout a lifetime. And as an impressionable 18 or 19-year-old, I just recall, after dinner, seeing this cart full of the broadest array of liqueurs I've ever imagined. And to this day, I have a very broad array of liqueurs for my guests. And the other lasting thing is actually epitomized by this. One day, I think at your household, we had a mulled cider. And I asked your mom for the recipe. And this is the same piece of paper that I wrote it on then. I just can't copy it again. This is like my oldest recipe. And so I would make, just in case some of you don't have this recipe, it is 1.5 ounces of rum, 1 teaspoon syrup, and 1 teaspoon sugar. So it's interesting. She obviously concocted this. I mean, did her research. 2 teaspoons of lemon juice and 6 ounces of cider. And I try to have it every year and get it for every time.
My name is Siki Manabe. The answer to my words, I'm very simple idea about me, the scientist who came in 1950. I'm the one. And probably I'm the oldest employee of GMPL. But when I arrived up there in 1958, it was, you know, World War II ended 1945. And so it's only a little more than 10 years. And so I was not sure, you know, going to the United States and working there. But, you know, first when I arrived at this national airport in, near Alexandria, and Joe greeted me at the airport, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, everything is new for me. And he was full of smiles and waiting at the airport, and then took me to his home. And I really felt at home and had a nice dinner. And of course, as soon as I arrived at there, Joe already started talking about in his basement about all his ambitious project. And then the dinner really enjoyed. And I actually stayed more than 1 week, you know. And almost as if I'm standing there forever. it was wonderful coming from Japan at that time and welcomed so much. And probably my career never existed without their help. You know, it won't get even started, I don't think. And so I owe them so much. And then, as you, many of you told, all these wonderful dinners, and Thanksgiving dinners, all these, every occasion, they kindly invited me and remembered all this. And so I am really grateful, and on this occasion I would like to say how thankful I am about what they did and made my life so much different. And I really would like to thank them for on this occasion. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to amend something. When Suki came, it must have been just before Fred was born. And my mother had this story that she sometimes told that she was 9+ months pregnant with Fred, and it was right before Suki was making one of his first public addresses about his scientific work. And so Dad was holding his hand for this whole thing, but it was a phone call. So my mother was in the basement. Dad was upstairs on the phone with Suki going, "Well, Suki, yeah, no, I think you should show this slide before that slide and then go into..." Meanwhile, my mother downstairs, her water had just broken. Just go, Joe! And she could hear him up through the microphone. And then after that, I think you'd better... I'm sorry,
no. I just want to say thank you. You've been a wonderful person to me. And I came to this country 21. So first I have to say about Suki, after his hard work of 5-6 years, Margaret really worried about whether Suki would get married or he couldn't have any girlfriend, American girlfriend. Meanwhile, the Japanese side also, they start worrying about American soil. He doesn't have anybody to support him. But luckily, Joe and Margaret was there. But anyway, he came back. So he got married, and I came back. The day which I came back from Kennedy Airport to National Airport, they invited me over right after I landed. And of course, she adopted. And she, "Can I be your daughter?" She said, "Fine, I have 3, but you could." And she taught me so many things about, of course, I've been into mission school in Japan, but I knew nothing about, just only Elvis Presley and nothing know about American custom. So she taught me everything. So it's, I'm really missing her. Last 6 months ago, I read it her last. She was complaining to Harriet and I wrote so many letters to Mom, Joe, but Joe never returned me. And she was really, really, she was crying. Yeah. So I said, "I don't know what to say to her." But anyway, she really missed Joe. They're like one of a kind, you know. So I think they're talking and Margaret having a martini. Sherry. And I remember, I was so fortunate to know them. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. And you named your first daughter Milton.
Margaret, yes, yes, she liked that.
This is just very quickly, because I didn't prepare anything about kind of Granny as our granny, but I kind of had a funny story that I think sort of speaks to her and how we thought of her. But you know, when you're a little kid, you have all these questions, and you're in school and you're learning lots of things for the first time, not as much relearning. And I always had lots of questions, I was constantly asking questions, and I had a day when I was maybe 6 or 7, and I came home from school, and we learned all this stuff that day, and I was telling my dad about it, and I I kind of had a moment and I said, does anyone know everything? And he said, well, I think Granny knows everything. And I was 6 or 7, and even though I questioned most things at the time, I didn't question that. And it kind of came back to bite me later on. I was in maybe my second grade class, and the teacher, you know, was talking about, you know, all these different fields of study, and she said, you know, of course, no person can know everything. And I said, actually, my granny knows everything. And she looked at me for a minute, and she said, that's really amazing. And then she moved on. But, you know, that was always my interpretation. She didn't know everything. She was our wise granny.
I'd just like to say something very brief. An event like this that's so beautiful and wonderfully carried out can seem spontaneous, but there's actually a lot of work that went into the planning. I'd just like to recognize my sisters, Terry and Ann, for really putting this whole thing together for us.
She provided us a normal situation at a time when you would just walk into a dining hall and everybody looked at you. And we needed that. We really did. We needed her hospitality, and we needed her warmth, and we needed her support, and we needed a family, because many of us had families far away. And I just like to remember her for that and honor her for that as part of Princeton history.
Well, I think we're going to finish up. I thought of something that I think needs to be said because it's so fun. If you've heard about these car rallies that we did, and I always look forward to the car rallies. And I actually would help my mom plan them. She'd drive back roads around for months looking for the most obscure routes and hiding places. And 1 year she had it all mapped out, and there was a bridge out. And she had to change the clues that morning, but she did it. And so it was a major effort. And actually, I only got to go on one as a participant once because I was in college and I wasn't around to help. And I actually had to go to a professor of mine and get a final exam postponed so that I could be on car rides. Yeah, I actually got my final exam. How I did that. But 1 year, I would say a large proportion of people in these rallies were people from the lab, many of whom were, English was not their native language. And Mom made absolutely no concessions. The clues were at, you know, the Saturday New York puzzle level quality. And everybody was just kind of thrown to the wolves. And 1 year, there was one of the cars that was out 2 hours later than everybody else. Oh, no, this is before cell phones or anything. Yeah, who knows where they were. But Mom decided 1 year that she was going to throw people a lifeline. And she gave everyone a sealed envelope and said, this is only to be opened in case you know, all hope is lost. And of course, the rules are strict. If this is unsealed, you disqualify yourself from the car route. It was a very competitive group. So what she had done was given everybody a map. But these were maps of London. So I just love the idea of someone out in the countryside scratching their head, giving up the frustration. Oh, I'm going to open it. perfectly capped if my mom says it. Okay, we are going to finish, I believe, with a song. Is that correct? I believe Jean Reza is going to lead us with a song. My mom loved when Jean sang.
We always used to sing, and you know, always your mother's parties, we sang. And of course, there was this big party, you know, and then we would be singing, and the party would move off to the other. We didn't care. We sang, and she loved that. In fact, I visited her once at Terry, and it was around Christmas time, I think, and we did sing this song. So, and maybe we can have some helpers here.
Does everybody have the words? Everybody knows the 12 days of Christmas. It's just that 9, 10, 11, 12, and then it's mixed up.
Is it overtime?
One side is two. We're going to start with 12 days and then end with all seven. This version, we're doing 9.
Oh,
man,
it's
a
well done.
We're
going to
do the 9 ladies dancing.
I don't know.
So you could do this. Can you remember this? 9 ladies dancing, and then 10 lords leaping. All the lords have to jump up, or and then 11 pipers typing and 12. Okay, we ready? All right. Well, let's practice it. Here's the partridge in the pear tree. Everybody is going to do this, right? Partridge in the pear tree. Okay. Two turtle doves. Just put your fingers like this. Yep. But you know what? You can just do this. Two turtle doves. Okay, and three French hens are sitting in a big nest. Four, that's perfect. Four calling birds. Okay. And well, five golden rings. So pretend you have a ring. And then six geese are laying. They're laying eggs. Seven swans are swimming.
This is like the Macarena.
Eight maids are milking. And then now here's the 9 ladies dancing. And, or you can just do this. And 12 lords are leaping. 11 pipers piping. And 12 drummers. Okay, we're ready?
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree. On the second day of Christmas, my true love sent to me two turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree. On the third day of Christmas, my true love came to me. Three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love came to me. Four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the fifth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the sixth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me six geese a-laying, five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the seventh day of Christmas, my true love gave to me seven swans a-swimming, six geese a-laying, five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the eighth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me eight maids of milking, seven swans of swimming, six geese of laying, five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the ninth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me nine ladies walking, seven swans a swimming, six geese a laying, five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the 10th day of Christmas, my true love came to me. 10 lords a-leaping, on 9 ladies dancing, 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 golden rings, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the 11th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 11 pipers piping, 10 lords a-leaping, 9 ladies dancing, 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 golden rings, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 12 drummers drumming, 11 pipers piping, 10 lords a-leaping, 9 ladies dancing, 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 golden rings, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
well, thank you so much.
We ask people to share with us. Sometimes we didn't all things ever.
Oh.
Since New Year's Eve, we'll be here very soon. Carrie wanted to include Auld Lang Syne. So
do you want
let's do it. How about if we stand up and join hands just for pretend it's me? Is that okay?
I'm not sure I know what we're
let's join.
Oh.
Okay,
cool.
Acquaintance be forgotten and never brought to mind. Should old acquaintance be forgotten and days of old lang syne? For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne.
Can we just all also say, I know some of you have come from great distances. I know it hasn't been easy for everyone who has joined us today. I know there were many people who wanted to join us and couldn't. It warms our hearts to see this room full of people who loved our mother. And we thank you so much for coming.
Good
Thank you.
I know. I'm